2000.
It's November 2nd, year 2000. Do we have a number for this?
I don't know the number. I think it might be 16, but I'm not sure.
This might be 16, but we're not sure. First time I came to Alaska was in 1958 with college graduates or people studying for a master's or after fellowships. This group that I met were clustered in Claremont, California, and this was my second time in Claremont. I knew nothing about Alaska. And there were people who were nursing me. I had suffered a bullet wound in Houston, Texas. And I was living in a shack at the back of this professor's house, I forget his name, in Claremont.
There's one thing that I don't know, which is how you got from Houston with the wound to Claremont. I mean, how that...
The fellow who took me down to Houston, J.R. Cooley, he felt that I would be safe down there. I was being pursued by a German girl, and there's nothing I could do about it. And furthermore, people should understand that her parents and relatives were killed by British night bombings, where they created a firestorm, removing oxygen from the air. So her parents died by fire. So I understood where she was coming from, and nobody else would understand where she's coming from. I thought, that's the way it is. World War II is still a battle for me. And for this reason, even if I'd been here legally at that time, I would have done nothing except just flee, you know. It seemed the right thing to do. Getting back to Claremont, I was fleeing this lady. And was caught up in an adventure in Houston, a number of them. I went back to New York and blah, blah, blah. The group of people I got to know were in Claremont was Frank Tyson, who came up to Fairbanks to go firefighting. These young men had fought fire in Alaska and worked their way through college doing this. They were experienced firefighters. They could earn between $5,000 and $7,000, which was a lot of money then, and the government deducted nothing from your paycheck. This came from a revolving federal fund, so if you added, you know, 26%, then you get the true figure, which you'd have to earn anywhere else. So this is a lot of money, free and clear. And they were explaining this to me, and they're saying, well, the party's over, Alf. We're going to leave you here, but it's not a good idea for you to stay here. You've been in this shack. We've not paid rent on it, and the professor out front is getting restive. And he's fed up with all the people coming in here, you know, with jugs of wine and song fest and stuff like that. The party is over, but you're welcome to come with us. So the group included Frank Tyson, this singing fellow,
Chris
Christopherson, Paul Kelly, Ray LaFleur, God rest his soul.
What was his name?
Ray LaFleur. He had a home site on Muskox and killed himself. One winter. Bill West, his brother Greg. These are interesting people. Greg is a Superior Court Justice in the state of Oregon. His brother owns a company in Northern California. Forget forget the name. It's a seaside town. He does offshore work. Paul Kelly went to work for. He went to work in publishing. He was a club fighter in New York, and we used to box with one another in Claremont. And he was employed, really, by another boxer who was the president of Doubleday, the books shops at that time, whose name was Biggio or Riggio.
How did you meet all these guys? I mean, how did you happen to encounter this shack in Claremont?
J.R. Cooley was a student there. He went to Claremont Men's College. The men I talk of were people who were in, had studied with him over a period of years.
So when you left Houston, he helped you get connected?
I was in his car, and I was treated by a doctor down there. I refused to go into the hospital because I was here illegally, and a gunshot wound.
Right.
You have to explain where you got it, you see. And I didn't want to explain where I got it. So I was... The wound was cauterized by a fellow who came out of Claremont Men's College. He's now a doctor down there.
So you were an alumnus.
I was treated by an alumnus.
So you were driven up somehow to Claremont from Houston.
Yeah, I was driven down there by J.R. Cooley and driven back to Claremont by J.R. Cooley. The signals being that the German girl had not returned, and she sort of blanched at the idea of going down to Texas, you see. And she had disappeared. There were rumors that she had gotten married, so it was all the signals were to come on back. Kelly introduced me to Chris Christopherson. And there were some other young people, and they were all trying to reached decisions about their life. Frank Tyson came up here and didn't come firefighting with us. He washed dishes at the Elks, but then got a fellowship to Calcutta, India. I often think about, you know, where in God's name, you know, why? This was to study urban renewals or what have you. You know, something ridiculous is imposed on that cadaverous place, you know. He went then to under the guidelines of this fellowship, and then got another year doing that. There's a guy named Healy, and he was working towards a PhD, and he dropped out. These are people who came up here and then dropped out for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And
you mean dropped out of school or dropped out of firefighting?
Dropped out of firefighting. The art department, the students at the art department were really the ones that were the catalyst for all the things that happened to me. They knew about de Kooning. Their teachers did not. They despised de Kooning. So I was sort of a cultural hero to them. Then there were people in social studies and in political science who got the idea that I was a New York Minuteman bomber, you see. And that was the problem. That's why I had, you know, I seemed to them, you know, a civilized person who was fighting, you know, the imperialist acts. And I thought, well, they're bringing me eggs, even caviar and stuff like this, blankets. Someone offered me, there were young ladies who would massage me, you know, with these exotic massages that are now so fashionable. And who the hell was I to say, no, you got me all wrong. And when I didn't respond to that, I moved away from the mic and refused to talk about it, then this kind of emulsified everything. People thought, this guy is a bomber, and if we become bombers, and this is how we have to act, cryptic, and so on and so forth. This is a dedicated man. Meanwhile, when it was learned, when Kelly learned, instantly, Mr. Riggio, the president of Doubleday Bookstores, defeated Rocky Graziano twice in the amateur ranks. And I think in the movie, somebody up there likes me, but whoever liked Rocky Graziano didn't like him when he climbed in the ring against Mr. Riggio. And Paul Kelly was a club fighter, and when Mr. Riggio stepped out of Doubleday bookstores, I believe that Paul Kelly moved up. So we're talking about boxers who would use this, channel this sort of energy and then brought it into careers. There was a network of boxers helping one another. Of course, the poor professionals who would sort of lost their brains and what have you, and I don't know who took care of them, except maybe the godfathers who supported them during their career, made some money out of them, but I doubt that very much. Anyway, I had some other friends, Cordell Hicks and Ben Nice, and there was a great deal of envy that I was going with this girl they called UC, which stands for Union Carbide, Miss Davis.
In California.
In California, in Claremont. So,
well, a question. Didn't you meet her in New York? I mean, wasn't there, I remember there was somebody with a car.
Yes.
And you drove across the country once?
Yes, yeah. We met in California, then we went to New York, and then came back in that fashion. There were some people who were saying there was a guy named Bob Cash, God rest his soul. He drove a little Volkswagen, I remember that. His name was unusual, and he remembered New York. I don't think he was a New Yorker, but he remembered Hamburger Heaven on Lexington Avenue. And I remember Bob Cash saying, "By God, you're the American dream, Alfred, you know, to have a girlfriend like that." He was the only one who was all in favor of this sort of thing. And anyway, the classes had ended at Claremont. I was enjoying the swimming pool, and a group of young men approached me at the swimming pool, and they said, "Oh, so you're a boxer, eh? And let's see you fight." And this is really how I met Chris Christopherson. And I looked at these guys, and they have something against me. They had approached the Davises in San Marino and said, "This guy, Alf, stabbed somebody at the Sage Hen," which is a bar on Baseline. Baseline is a road that I think tags along the mountains, that mountain ridge that goes through California. And there was a bartender named Alfie, but he wasn't English and so on and so forth. And they concocted a whole story that I was that man, you know. Actually, the truth of the situation was they could have concocted an even furious story. Why they didn't go there and say I was one of the mad bomber on the run, I don't know why, you know. So they were going to whip my ass. And I thought, God, these are really decent people because they're not jumping me at the same time. And I thought, wow, this is fair. And I really looked forward to this and tried to hide my enthusiasm. And anyway, and sadly, this is how I met Paul Kelly, really. I learned that this former club fighter was doing a paper on pre-restoration plays or poetry, see.
Pre-restoration.
Yeah. Okay. And his appearance, the flat nose, and would belay this sort of endeavor or enterprise. I boxed with him, and I thought, well, I outreach him, and there was something slow about him. I thought, this guy isn't well. He used to box once upon a time. He's not punchy, he's not well. So he handed me over to some other guy, poor Benjamin Nice. We went down to Mexico, we became good friends after this.
Poor, you mean these are people you whipped?
Yeah. And anyway, I thought, this man's abs or abdominals are very loose. I thought, one punch there should settle his hash. And I came into Ben, who was the one who went to the Davis family, and hit him in the belly, and he retired from the fray and was helped by two other people. See, there was another guy who had nothing against, but I thought, all these are conspirators, you know, and so I just flattened him. He was scared by what had happened to Ben and just walked into a right that I threw. And then anyway, surveying the scene was Christofferson. I was surveying him. I thought, well, he's 155 pounds. I'm 147. But he leans to the right. And his record was of 5 knockouts in the first round, which is really very promising. And 1 loss by knockout. So, ha-ha. And anyway, I moved towards him, found that I could throw combinations immediately and at once without. And I remember the gym at the end of the semester, they turned off the air conditioning and the temperature was about 110 or more. And I insisted that we box on a wrestling mat. And because I was really fearful of knocking these guys down on the floor, and they're getting an embolism when their head would hit a hard floor. Mm-hmm. But very rough when you have to maneuver and you have speed. Well, anyway, I thought, this guy's a boxer, and he's in on this Davis thing. So I started hitting him, you know, just freely. And then Paul Kelly stepped in and said, that's enough. So we all went down to the swimming pool, and Christofferson wanted to talk to me. He said, I was offered a job in as a boxer with the stable of Art Aragon, who was the Californian welterweight champion, called the Golden Boy. And he wanted me to join his stable, and he figures he can develop me as a fighter. He saw me box Golden Gloves. And what do you think? I said, what do I think? You outweigh me. I haven't boxed in decades. And I hit you with rights. There was no answer to combinations, you know. I started boxing when I was 8 years of age. My brothers were boxers, I said to him. I said, it'll take you 3 years and 20 fights to learn to defend yourself. And if that happens, you might not have much of a brain left. See, you might not like this profession you're going into. Mm-hmm. And I said that Art Aragon is a power amongst Hispanic fighters, California into Mexico. But that's not where the money is. It's in the East. And that would be a mistake. I said, the whole thing will be a mistake. You have to think about it. And I said, what are you going to do? He said, well, I want a Rhodes Scholarship. I said, you mean you can go to jolly old England, to Oxford, and study there, and you're going to get mixed up with this pack of punchers, you know? I said, why don't you go there? Go to England. You know, just forget it. You're just going to have a hard time, you know. And this is difficult for me to tell you this because, and I'm 30. See, you're 23 years of age? And I did all of this to you, you see. And it must mystify you that you didn't hit me once, you see. And I'm fighting in your environment. I come from New York, England, and the temperature up there was, 110, you know. And I beat the hell out of you. And people your weight and your size who are professional will knock you out, you see. And others learn to knock you out, you see. So anyway, he came up here and joined Mike Tyson washing dishes at the Elks, and then returned, then said he was going to England to take up the Guggenheim. I met some other people there. Dave Hampton also went to Oxford to study at Ruskin. I said, don't study at Ruskin. But anyway, Christopherson went there. This was the town of folk singers. There's a young lady named Joan Baez singing her head off, you know, her parents. One of them was a doctor, the other was a professor, believe it or not, you know. But no one ever said that Christopherson sang or did anything like that. You know, we would go out on these beer parties, you know, and he wouldn't sing or do anything like that. He would drink, you know. So he was a mystery to me, but he went to England, and he sent me a copy of the overseas edition of Time magazine, you know, the British version. And I wondered, what is all this about? And I looked in the sports section, and there was a picture of him. And in England, they have Greco-Roman wrestling. This is what you people enjoy at the Olympic Games. And it's in different weight divisions. It's not Hulk Hogan, all these people. It's pure wrestling, and it's in different weight divisions, similar to boxing. So he wrestled within his division. And at the end of his bouts in Oxford, he boxed there. He wrestled, then went on to Northampton, and then to Coventry. These cities get larger and larger. And at the end of his bouts, he would sing. And then would arrive for his wrestling matches with a guitar and sing, and the people went bananas for him. So from boxing or wrestling, he emerged in this way, you know, touch people. I've had no contact with him. I've had contact with all the other people. He married a young lady named Stormy, who was engaged to Ray LaFleur, the late Ray LaFleur, out of the Muskox. This was like someone stealing your wife, you know, that this belongs to Saney College years. And then he had a drug problem and was really incommunicado to all the people who knew him from school. This group of people, I remember we came up here in three cars. And we in Seattle, I think people were treating me like the old man amongst this group of people. It's like when I go to a sketch class, people bring me a chair, you know, and I creak and stuff like this. Well, to 22, 23, 25-year-old, someone who's over 30 is really ancient. So they would sort of take care of me on this trip, and they all decided that I should go with this fellow they were meeting in Seattle. His name is Julian Rivers. He would be the first Alaskan I ever met, really, you know, someone who lived here. And his father was a congressman for Alaska at that time. And anyway, they said, you're going to like it in traveling with Julian. We also had, we were also going to go, apart from firefighting, we were going to go and scoop up gold on the 70-mile river near the Nickahom. And we had the first suction dredge that ever operated. And the other fellows researched this out, and they thought that the 70-mile river had never been this technology hadn't reached this place. It was once a major gold field. And also they felt too, from the study of geological maps in Claremont, that the floor of the river was a natural river bed. All we need to do is go in there and scoop up this gold and become rich. Of course, gold was about, I don't know, $30 or $35 an ounce in those days. So I might say that we spent 30 hours underwater without a cursed dredge, and we had just a small vial of gold for all of these efforts. But anyway, I climbed into the car. It was a luxurious Chevrolet with air conditioning, you see. And the other cars were sort of loaded down with people going back and be very uncomfortable. And I was perched above equipment. And so when I saw this car driven by Julian, I thought, yep, that's the place for me. And we all drove up the highway together. Of course, the other fellows were constantly having tire problems, you know. And one of the student cars had been purchased for $75. It had been passed on around campus, you know. And I think it was abandoned when they got to Fairbanks. But here's this pristine, this brand new cream-colored Chevy, and it was just wonderful in there. Then we all went into this lodge and restaurant in Toke. I was there a couple of years ago. I don't recognize it. There are hotels there now and tourist places and houses. It's not recognizable to me. But anyway, we all went in there, you know, to stretch, walk around in the night, and eat something in the lodge house. You know, the first civilized meal where we sit at a table, and everyone enjoyed this. And everyone's telling me about firefighting, that they'd you're gonna have a wonderful time, and you know, we'll teach you all we know, and you'll be in our crew, and we're hot shots, you know. We've had the experience. This is, you are in a hot shot crew. And anyway, we all came out of the roadhouse, and we're heading back to the cars. And I remember there was a wind that was stirring leaves on the highway, and I felt something. And I said, I'm not getting back in that car. And I remember that, and the moon was out.
What did you feel?
I felt that something dangerous was happening. I felt that I was back in the war. And I felt, you know, we had air raid alarms in London. And they would go off and warn you that the enemy was in the vicinity. But the dogs in London were the warning that you got. And you would get a half hour before the signal, you'd hear dogs barking all over the city. And you knew the people who meant you harm were flying through the air at you. I got this same feeling. And these arguments broke out. They said, Jesus Christ, what car are you going to get into? I said, I don't care. I said, if you like, I'll hitchhike into Fairbanks. Just where is it? They said, then I'll hitchhike. I don't give a damn.
Do you know what it was, the guts that triggered this
thing?
Wasn't the dogs barking or anything like that?
No dogs barking, but I felt something down the highway where we would have headed to Anchorage. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't get back in the car with Julian. And I couldn't explain what was happening to me. So this time they found a very uncomfortable place for me to sit. I was in this little two-door sedan, you know, one of those old Chevy things, and I had to lie on top of this equipment they had, like a big bulge. And whenever the car would bump, my legs and knees would hit the ceiling of this vehicle.
You were heading to Anchorage?
No, I refused to go to Anchorage. Now I'm back in the car with Ray LaFleur.
I know, but Anchorage or Fairbanks? I mean, you're at Tok, so...
Julian was picking up a car for a fellow in Anchorage.
Got it, okay.
And we were heading for Fairbanks.
I was supposed to go to
Anchorage and then come back on the railroad or what have you. And I said, I'm not getting back in that car. And I said, I can't explain it. If you don't want to take me, you know, then I'll hitchhike. I don't care. I'm not getting in that car. Anyway, everyone dispersed, and I went back into this old vehicle. And we drove in silence, really. Well, it was nighttime, and people were tired. And we arrived in Big Delta, and there was an uproar because they said a car that was heading down the highway, the Elliott Highway to Anchorage, had a head-on collision with another vehicle just 8 or 10 miles from Tok, and it was Julian. He'd broken his neck. Fortunately, they chopped him out of there. The military got a hold of him. So he survived. The wreckage of the car indicated that it hit on my side. The fellow came over the center line and slammed into the car and it rolled over. But I would have not survived that.
Yeah. Wow.
So then we...
By then, did these folks know who you really were? I mean, knew you weren't a mad bomber or something like that? Or did they still...
Oh, yeah, they knew who I was. They knew who I was. And there's something else I told them, because I want to be fair. I said, I'm in the country illegally. And if you transport me, you can be liable, you see. I'm telling them this in Claremont. I said, but don't worry. I've gone through borders. I've been down to Mexico on the liquor run. I've taken my turn. And I...
You went and you came through Canada in this car?
Yeah. And now we're approaching... I've got to mention that we went through,
went through what?
We went by the guard post through the immigration. The officers suspected that there was marijuana. They felt there was a smell of marijuana. They couldn't find any though. And as for me, in Sacramento, where we picked up Pierre Venerat, I was visiting the Salvation Armies and the Goodwills all along the way, looking for something. And what I found was an Eagle Scout uniform. I embroidered my name on it, and that's how I came through. And the guy made a deal with me, of all people, the only one that he could throw into Durant's vial. He says, I trust you to keep an eye on these boys, you know. I said, I will. I promise you. And he says, we're checking in the station at Tanner Cross. And then these boys will be fighting fire out of Big Delta. And I assure you that you have no reason to. They will be behaving themselves. And I'm sure you're incorrect about marijuana. I've been with these chap fellows, you know. And so they let all of them through all my niceness. So that was one thing they had reason to fear, but it didn't turn out that way, you know. And we went on to Big Delta. holding forth in Big Delta was a fire boss. The federal officer in charge of the district was her name, Michael Maguire. And he was called Mickey Maguire, the man of fire. And we reported to him for work. And I must say that we weren't smoking pot or anything like that. Someone may have. I mind the other cars, I don't know. But when we reached Alaska, the boys were smoking these cigarillos and cigars and cigarettes and throwing them out onto the tundra.
God.
I know that, you see. And yeah, the firefighters. And they were explaining to me how inflammable the brush is, you see. And I'd say we were lighting fires all along the route. And then we checked in with Maguire. He said, yeah, you're just in time. We got a fire here. It's one of these goddamn jobs where we, for the military, they got smoke up in the hill and they can't see where they're going at Fort Greeley, or they figure they aren't going to see anything. So they're sending people in, and we're going to have, all of this is foreign to me. And there'll be a boy infusion, whatever the hell that meant. And you guys are going to be there, and the army will chopper you in from Fort Greeley. And I thought, chopper, bore eight. And they said, who's this guy here? They said, oh, that's Al Skondovich. Oh, Skondovich, yeah, well, he probably knows the territory because of the Vich in the end of my name. And the fact that I was wearing in the evenings I'd wear a smoking jacket with embroidered curlicues that I ripped off at USC, where this came from an Oscar Wilde play, the importance of being earnest was this jacket I wore with the curved pipe, you see, and desert boots. These are totally inappropriate for this sort of action. And anyway, we arrived at the base. We were to take off at dawn, and they had these huge choppers, and I forget what they were, Koskiw, I don't know what the name of the choppers were, but they were big choppers, and the wind was fierce down there. The wind was 40 and 50 miles per hour. And they take off. We'd walk into these choppers just outside of a hangar, and some of them would fight the wind, you know. And then they deposited us on the riverbank of the Good Pastor. This is over 40 years ago, and this year I went back to where I fought fire. Remember, I could see the saddle, you see. And anyway, they flew us in there, and we had a transmitter. We also had walkie-talkies, but we had a lot of World War II surplus equipment. For instance, the sea rations that we had were surplus from World War II that we ate, you see. And there was always bartering for different foods at night. I remember, and the first time I ever started smoking was when I received these free cigarettes in there. And I remember the tobacco would spill out. You'd have to cinch up the ends, you know. And also, I remember telling this army veteran, I said, you know, I really like those sea rations, you know. But people laugh at me, but... I mean, they were good. I loved the hard-boiled candy in them. He said, what? Hard-boiled candy. I said, the red and green things, you know, I'd suck in them all day. He said, God, man, that was a jelly-type thing, and it had just hardened through the years. He said, and there were foods that had undergone this transformation, the tobacco and these jellied candies were hard as rocks, and I loved it. We were deposited on the banks of the river, and another chopper came in with more equipment for us. And the military crews had been deposited somewhere else. During the night they fought fire, but were to be withdrawn. And we began climbing up this hill with our equipment and this radio transmitter. Anyway, the transmitter was a suitcase-sized device, and you'd have to put aerials up into the trees. There were four aerials. And we were going to put this up near the fire, and then all of a sudden, planes came in to bomb the fire with borate. And this is a liquid dust, you know, if it's dropped at the wrong altitude, the rush of this chemical, it will disintegrate into dust. But ideally it hits the ground as a kind of an emulsification, you see, like a clay. Mm-hmm. And we were being hit with this from these huge World War II bombers. And we all looked like statues in red. And embarrassingly enough, it's a kind of a laxative. So we had a form of dysentery. Then I remember I thought, we have to set up the transmitter. This was an easy job for me, to keep me away from the fire. So now I'm in a critical role, and I'm climbing up trees, and the other guy's got the idea to climb up a tree too, to put up the other aerials. There were four in all. And the bombers came back. So here, now we're in the trees, and we get hit with borate. You know. So that was my first experience with fire out of Fort Greely. And then we were joined by a native crew. There was a guy named Curly, there was a fellow named Frenchy, and I asked for these people in Big Delta when we went up the Good Pasture to visit Paddy's friends. But they're long since gone, and the man of fire, Mickey McGuire, became an inspector of aircraft with the FAA, with the state, no longer did firefighting. Everyone seemed to be ashamed of this sort of activity, and they wouldn't fess up to it. Fighting fires, yeah. And then we came on to Fairbanks, and we reported for firefighting there. There were all three of saying, you don't have to worry about a thing, you know. And I said, I'm not worried. But this is something I really had no experience at. And they said they'd cover for me. These are six-man squads. And, you know, one of your friends will be the straw boss. We're hot shots, said Ray LaFleur. So anyway, we all checked in at the fire station, and I signed my name on a list, and it was given to the dispatcher. And I think to stick out in the crowd, we shaved off all our hair. So we looked like these latter-day skinheads, but it wasn't sort of a pejorative thing then, you know. So here I am walking around without any hair on my head, you know, and the importance of being Ernest Jacket seemed ridiculous in life, and I threw it away. And then, of all the people that arrived, we stayed at a place called the Igloo Motel, and there were little concrete igloos in which you lived, and in which the firefighters lived there, nobody else. And sometimes you would rent a bed in an igloo, but two other people would rent the same bed, but they'd all be out on fires. And there was never any never a problem. There, no one came back and said, get out of my bed. You would just shift around and find some other spot. Anyway, the dispatcher called me. I thought, well, they found out about me. I have no experience, and that's what this is all about. So I went over to the fire station, full of these thoughts. And you know, there people who talk at you and try to to say, no, that's not the way it is, please. And this fellow was saying, we have a new policy at the Bureau of Land Management. We're going to go in, we're going to have indigenous firefighters fighting in this area. And we've chosen you to lead a crew out here because, you know, the governor was a guy named Mike Stepovich. The senior senator then was Perotovich. Batrovich represented this area. There were bitches all over the goddamn place. So this guy thought I was one of these. So he said, you'll be a straw boss here, and you'll choose your crew and come back here. I hope you find indigenous people or blah, blah, blah. And all the time I'm saying, I don't know, you know. And you'll be totally ignored. Because they were doing this initiative thing.
I would like to interrupt. We're just about out of time.
Okay.